Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to Fun Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Our co-host Rachel cannot be with us today. We are pre-recording before the show tonight. Tonight being October 16th, we are really excited about today's show to have our friend from overseas across the pond, Pete Brown, in the house.
Hi, how's it going?
Fantastic. Oh, wow.
Ooh.
There are noises happening. We're not really.
We're inside a converted shipping container and something just fell on the roof, but it did not come through, so all good.
Before we get too into things, I just want to say thank you to all the people that have been coming through the brewery over the past few weeks at Fifth Hammer. The outpouring of love and appreciation from the neighborhood has been tremendous, and we are really excited about the journey. I almost have all taps filled with our beer. I just moments ago finished kegging a cherry Berliner Weiss style American sour tart. And I'm excited to pour it tonight. It is New York Rye Week, so there's some events happening this week put on by New York Distilling. If you go to, is it NYC Rye Week?
It's just ryeweek.com.
Ryeweek.com. There's a bunch of fun things happening. We'll be pouring some rye beer at NY Distilling on Saturday that we aged in a rye barrel from NY Distilling or New York Distilling. I'm excited about that. A lot of rye. I love rye. Love the spiciness. But enough about me. What do you think about me? Wait, no. Pete Brown.
I think you're great.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for coming on. So you have authored 8 books, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
And your most recent just came out.
Yes.
It's called Miracle Brew, Hops, Barley, Water, Yeast, and the Nature of Beer.
Yeah.
So let's start with that. That's why you're here.
Yeah. So it's been a while since I wrote my last beer book. My first 3 books were about beer. And
what was the first of those 3?
That was called Man Walks Into a Pub.
Mm-hmm.
And then my writing kind of went away from beer. UK publishers said, we love your style, we love your writing. Kind of had enough about beer now. Can you write about something else? Take it to McGarry. And then I did that for a few years and then realized I was missing beer too much. So I decided to come back to it. And Miracle Brew is inspired by the fact that beer is the most popular alcoholic beverage in the world. Third most popular beverage overall behind tea and coffee. And in an age where we're more and more curious about where our food comes from, where our food and drink comes from and what it contains and how it was made, very, very few beer drinkers are actually aware of what beer is made from,
mm-hmm.
which I just found really bizarre and curious. And a survey in the UK last week showed that 22% of people are aware of the ingredients of beer and 88% of people think that it's important that their food contains natural products. So there's a huge gap there. And so it felt like a good idea to write a book about what's in beer and why it's there and what it's doing.
How did your journey into beer, where did your love for beer come from?
So I came from the dark side. I started off working in advertising.
Okay.
I wanted to work in advertising because when I was growing up in the UK, beer advertisements were the most entertaining things on television. We went through a little bit of a fallow period in terms of TV comedy, and the ads were funnier than the programs. Mm-hmm. I know Jim Cook from Boston once said something like, I love beer ads, I could watch beer ads all day, just don't ask me to drink the beer. And in those days, beer ads really were funny. They were great. The idea was, you know, all the beers taste identical, so you create brands in order to separate them. And I wanted to work in advertising because I wanted to work on ads like that. I ended up working on ads like that. I worked on Heineken and Stella Artois in the UK, and it was my involvement in that that led me to become much more curious about the role of beer in society. My job was to kind of look at cultural trends and insights, and I was fascinated by the passion that people had for beer, and I wanted a book that would give me more of an insight into that area. But all the books in the UK were about, here are the 50 best beers in the world, here are the 50 best real ales in the UK. And I was like, yeah, okay, but what about how they're drunk? What about why people drink them? What about why we have this tradition? And there was nothing about that. So eventually I thought, I'm going to write that myself. And never look back.
And that's where a man walks to a pub, comes
yeah.
into
mm-hmm. yeah.
comes in. Awesome.
Yeah, so that was the first book. You know, the start of 1,000 different jokes.
Yeah.
And it's a great title. But by the way, I never come up with the titles for my books. I'm awful at coming up with titles for books. That was from someone else, but it's a great title for that book because there's a reason why so many jokes start with man walks into a pub. There's this level of surrealism in a lot of those jokes. A penguin walks into a pub and says, have you seen my brother? And the barman says, I don't know, what does he look like? And the thing is, if you try telling those kind of jokes, a man walks into Starbucks or a penguin walks into Starbucks,
It doesn't have the same thing.
It doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't work. But the pub is this environment where you will suspend that disbelief. And there's that kind of thing about beer that just allows that sort of absurdist humour to come out. That's kind of the tone of the book as well. It's a very serious factual book, but written in a style that you would hope that kind of information, that kind of content would be delivered at a bar stool rather than from behind a lecture pulpit.
Mm-hmm. I was handed that book. My friend and I started a brewery called Wandering Star in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and as he had just gotten that book, found it hilarious and loved it, and handed it to me, and I got through it. It's wonderfully entertaining, and
Thank you.
I love everything that happens. The stories are awesome. But the new book, you just said something about tradition of beer, but I heard a rumor that you don't favor cask ale much anymore.
Oh, yeah, I've been getting a lot of. Here's the thing, and the reason this isn't an issue for me personally is because I was the author of something called the Cask Report for 9 years in the mm-hmm. UK, and the function of this report was to promote cask ale, to sing its virtues, to prove to publicans why they should be stocking it. And after 9 years, I decided to withdraw from doing that because I was being given too tight a brief. I'd always said that I would write a very positive report, but mm-hmm. it would be honest.
Right.
And that position became compromised. Yeah. And it was what that's been doing is it's been really kind of the report and a lot of the other energy around it, around cask at the moment, has led to a massive growth of the distribution, the availability of cask ale. But cask ale is a very special, mm-hmm. unique kind of beer. You need to know what you're doing with it. It requires some extra attention, care and effort in the cellar of the pub. And it's being stocked in a lot of pubs now that don't have the expertise, that don't have the knowledge and frankly don't care.
Right.
And so where I live in London, most pubs that stock cask ale are serving a substandard product.
Right.
That's just not good enough. The public are not educated on it, so they don't know that this is substandard. The typical thing when you take a pint back to a bar and say, this beer's not right, is, well, no one else has complained.
Right,
and you're like, yeah, they don't know how to complain. They don't know what to complain about. And so you look around these pubs and you see pints of cask ale that are kind of two-thirds still full that have been abandoned on the table.
Yeah.
And you're just like, this is not right. This is going to kill cask ale.
Yeah.
And my message was to... I thought it would be shocking if I said I've stopped drinking cask ale in London, which I have, because there's just too many pubs that are bad.
They're doing it the wrong way. Sure.
And my message was, look, if you're not prepared to put this extra care and attention and effort into it, just don't stock it. Please do us all a favour. Let the guys who care about it stock it and just leave it alone if you're not going to put that effort in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's opened up a bit of a debate.
Yeah.
So what is your personal take on how to serve cask? Like, do you believe in cask breathers? And
I do believe in cask breathers. I think my thing is that the campaign for Ale Ale, I mean, this is a whole huge rabbit hole.
I know,
take
us, I know. We'll do the American version, the American, you know, yeah, concise.
a little widget on the top of a cask that stops oxygen from getting in and allows a natural blanket of carbon dioxide to sit on top of the beer, so it lasts longer.
About 2 PSI-ish.
Sorry?
About 2 PSI-ish, yeah, yeah, coming in there, yeah.
So the campaign for Ale Ale, or certain large parts of it, think that cask breathers are not natural, it's not real ale, it's not real cask if you do it. I've yet to find a cask ale brewer who thinks that cask breathers are a bad thing.
Right.
And I would tend to side with the guys who make the beer rather than the people who are on their own pulpits about it. But whatever it is, I think if you've got a pub cellar, it's a bit like, you know, I make my own sourdough now, and so I'm kind of very much aware of how yeast and also the research for the book, you know, yeast responds and reacts to its environment. It evolves within its environment. And one pub cellar is not the same as another pub cellar. And you need to take the time and go, okay, well, the instructions say that I should leave this beer to breathe for 3 days before putting it on sale. But in my cellar, it kind of needs an extra day, or it kind of only needs 2 days. And just having that love and that passion for it. Yeah, we spend too much time going, we're passionate about this, and then our actions don't live up to those words. And when you get a publican who's totally, totally fascinated by cask ale and really into it, you know you're in very good hands. Mm-hmm. But it's an obsession, it's a hobby, and it's a vocation beyond just the kind of, okay, I've ticked all the boxes on the form. For example, I did a cellarmanship course about 10 years ago. I am a qualified cask ale cellarman, and that terrifies me. Because I don't know how to do it.
But
it was a 1 day course. There was a multiple choice test at the end, and they gave us the answers, and then we got a certificate saying we'd passed the course. Yeah, that's just not what cask ale needs.
Yeah,
we have enough. I mean, here in the U.S., obviously we have some cask ale, and it's probably a whole nother controversy. But here in the U.S., we have enough trouble just teaching bar owners to keep their draft lines clean.
I mean,
if you can't even keep a draft line properly clean, there's no way you can take care of a cask ale.
No, that's
Or, make sure that your kegs, they go into the cold box and they stay there until they're kicked.
Not enough that nobody's complained yet.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I just think, you know, beer needs to be treated with that kind of care and attention. I was inspired to kind of get more vocal about this by a visit to Belgium last year. I went to visit Dryfonteinen, who just started brewing their own lambics again, that they then blended to their gers. And those guys don't want to grow exponentially. They want to work with bars that understand their beer. They want to develop deep relationships with a handful of suppliers, with a handful of retailers, and make sure that the beer is the best wherever it is. And it's like, well, that should be enough for people. And if this place isn't going to put the care and attention in, I'm going to rip it out of there and not let them sell my beer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's something we talk about a lot. As also, we're even owning a brewery, talking about, you know, are we going to do crowler or growler fills? We just got a crowler machine. What about cans? What about bottles? You know, what happens to your kegs when they go out in the world? Because as a brewer, if your beer is meant to taste and smell and be a certain way, you don't want that to change when it goes out in the world, you know, for however that is.
I think this is one of the things that's so interesting about the growth of tap rooms in the US. I was speaking to Bob Peace from the Brewers Association, and he was saying that tap rooms are becoming, you know, the big growth driver at the moment. That's the kind of the new model that people are following. And I think that's really interesting. I think from a consumer point of view, it's probably more about being hyper-local than it is, which is another interesting thing. But I think, you know, if you're making your beer and you're putting it through your lines and you're selling it in your place, there's not going to be anywhere better than that, is there?
Right.
Definitely, definitely. And the other thing I think is interesting, at least, you know, we've only been open for a little over 2 weeks now, but I see it in other breweries. I'm secretary of the New York City Brewers Guild right now. So we go, you know, I go and visit a lot of breweries, and I feel like the brewery tasting rooms here in New York City are really community places.
Yes.
They
yes.
draw a lot of neighborhood. They host community events. And it's really cool. And that's something that we do see in some bars, but I feel like it's even more of that atmosphere in a lot of the tasting rooms.
I think there's so much richness there. I mean, beer, when I get sentimental about beer, it's all about it being a community thing. It's all about beer brings people together. Mm-hmm. I've always described it as the most sociable drink in the world. And we're seeing some, not many yet, but some brewers doing a similar thing. We, where I live in North London, in Hackney. It's kind of the scaled down equivalent of Williamsburg in New York City. It's that kind of area. And there's a brewer there, 40 foot, and they're literally 5 minutes walk from my house. And there's a very big Turkish and Kurdish population in the area. And there's a Turkish food writer who was exiled by Erdogan, who was really into his beer. I mean, God knows what he was writing about food in order for the president to see him as a threat, you know. The brewer's been working with him and his colleague, and they're kind of matching up their beers with Turkish food and getting a big grill out outside the brewery and doing these kind of kebab and beer nights, and it's just wonderful, you know. And things, there's also a big Caribbean community there. And getting these old Caribbean people out, Afro-Caribbeans, and just kind of make brewing stouts, especially for them that remind them of home.
It's the melting pot
doing kind of food, that kind of food as well. It's just beautiful.
Awesome. We are going to take a very brief break, and we'll be right back.
Break. She's not going to bake between. But mad about it.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to For Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are here in the studio with Pete Brown. His latest book called Miracle Brew, Hops, Barley, Water, Yeast, and the Nature of Beer. We were just talking about a lot of what the nature of beer is, being a social lubricant. The lubricant of social intercourse, I believe, is what I like to call it.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty good.
That's kind of the nature of beer. Mary, yeah.
That reminds me of a recent conversation we had. No, so let's talk about. So I think writing a book is an arduous, long
yes.
process. But there's always things that you discover or take you by surprise. I would say, was there anything like that?
That always
happened in this book.
For me, every book I write changes my life in some way. It's the joy. The reason I write books, it's certainly not for the financial gain. It's because of the amount that I learn and the journey. I hate using that word in that context, but the journey that I go on when I'm writing it and the things
Hops
that I learn.
And Glory had one, and
Hops and Glory was literally
literally has a little.
God, this time 10 years ago, I was slowly losing my mind on a container ship.
That's a great book, and I've been handed. I was just telling you in between that sets, I've been handed that book twice.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, that's Barry, great. IPAs here, this book. And it's a great, great book.
Thank you. I mean, this one's got elements of all my previous books, really. There was a lot of the great thing about it in the publisher that I did this with in the UK. It's called Unbound, and they have this kind of new crowdfunding model. It's kind of a subscription model, which is how books used to be done hundreds of years ago. And so normally when you're writing a book, you keep your cards pretty close to your chest until the book's done. This one, I had to go out and talk about it in order to crowdfund it. And so that produced this very unexpected effect, which was I was going to write it mainly from a theoretical standpoint. And then as soon as I was talking about the book and what it was going to be about, people started getting in touch and saying, well, if you're going to do that, you need to come over here and see us. You need to come out here and do this thing with us. So it turned into more of a travel book than I was expecting it to. So for the hops part, I picked hops in Yakima Valley, which mm-hmm. was always been a lifelong ambition. I picked hops in Tasmania.
Well, wow.
which was just incredible because a brewer down there, Stone & Wood, said, mate, you're missing out half, you're missing out an entire hemisphere from this.
Southern hemisphere. Southern
hemisphere. Beautiful. Yeah, I ended up going to Bamberg and looking at Wyman maltings there mm-hmm. and exploring smoke malt. Going to maltings myself in the west of England, and understanding things kind of firsthand, and I've always found in everything to do with beer that you can read as many books as you want, but there's no substitutes for seeing it and doing it yourself and coming to understand it from that point of view. So I started the book thinking I'm going to, referred to pretty universally as a beer expert, I thought I would put aside what I thought anyway about ingredients. And I was right to do so because most of it was wrong. I had malting completely wrong in my head. And I've been telling people rubbish about malting for years. So doing it, I went to traditional floor maltings and pulled the rake to turn the malt mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. And it was just a joyous thing to get up close and personal with the different ingredients. Going to yeast labs where there's a national yeast collection in the southeast of England after the Blitz, and a lot of breweries were destroyed. And when the brewery's destroyed, the yeast culture gets destroyed. So you can never quite recreate the beer. So in 1951, the brewing industry created this cryogenic vault of different brewers' yeasts. And now you can go there and wow. call up all these yeasts from forgotten breweries and that kind of thing. So that was pretty awesome.
I was not aware of that. That's very cool. I wonder what the shipping is like overseas. I'm starting to count. Nature of beer and the people you've seen on this. So what is that part of the chapter when it comes to nature?
The nature of beer. I think it starts off, actually, the start of the book is a friend of mine works for a brand called Carling, biggest mainstream like macro brand in the UK, and they decided that because the brand has been commoditized and craft is kind of turning people's heads, mm-hmm. they would dial up the natural attributes of the beer. And so they did these posters with just a simple glass of beer in a field of barley, and it said Carling, made with 100% British barley. And people like me went, oh, I thought they used kind of malt extracts and rubbish and stuff. That makes me reappraise the brand. Loyal Carling drinkers said, I don't want grass in my beer. Can't you go back to making it out of chemicals like they always used to? And they got complaints. You know, they've always made it out of 100% British barley. But when they told people that's what it was made out of, loyal drinkers started complaining that it didn't taste as good as when it was made out of chemicals. Wow. And beer has that reputation, which I think is very sad. And so I wanted to kind of really focus on the fact that this is a natural product. The last book I did was a book called The Apple Orchard, which was following on from a book I wrote about cider. And I wanted to go one step back from cider to the culture around the orchards where it's grown, apple varieties, the mythology and history of the apple. And so this book was partly an attempt to recycle that idea with beer. Yeah. I knew, okay, the apple is to cider what hops, barley, water, yeast are to beer. And just revel in the kind of naturalness and that getting close to the land. I think there's a big trend. The more time we spend online and in virtual worlds, the more we have a need to reconnect with the land mm-hmm. and with nature. I think nature writing has been a huge growth in nonfiction in the last 5 years. And the cynical side of me is like, right.
It reminds me of one of my favorite quotes. I know I say it all the time, so Mary's probably tired of me saying it, but... Randy Mosher wrote a book called Tasting Beer.
Yes.
And in the beginning of this book, he talks about because of the interpersonal relationship between terroir and the grape, it's said that God, however you define that, makes wine. But beer, man makes beer because of all the human touches that happen from the grain, or after you get it from the grain, after you get it from the terroir, and the choices the brewers make to put it into a beer, it's like it's man-made. And every time you take a sip, you're taking... It's a window into the brewer's soul, and I always thought that was very beautiful. But with all that, it still starts in the ground and with nature.
It does. I think it's an interesting point on which to compare. And I would totally compare cider to wine, But it's an interesting comparison. When you talk to winemakers, they're quite jealous of brewers in some ways, because as you've experienced, you can start up a brewery, get the kit, and within a couple of weeks you can be running a test brew.
Right.
If you want to start a winery, you've got to find the soil, plant the vines, and wait for 7 years. Right. So beer, you are free to pull these different ingredients from all sorts. I make the point in the book that you could be a brewer in... You could be a brewer in New York using hops from the Yakima Valley, barley from Germany, and you're still a local brewer because mm-hmm. you're making the beer there in Brooklyn or whatever. But when you trace the ingredients back to the source, the terroir of each one is just as important as mm-hmm. it is with wine, as it is for grapes. And terroir was a concept that I spent a lot of time thinking on in the book. And what surprised me is that of all the ingredients, because terroir relates to all of them, really importantly, but probably water is the most terroir-influenced of all. And I like the best English translation I've heard for terroir is land taste, which I really like as a term.
Land taste.
Yeah. And when you get water falling as rain, and it then flows through the ground, mm-hmm. And the character of the water is dictated by the rock, the soil, the shale it flows through, that is the most literal expression of land mm-hmm. taste that I can possibly think of. You're literally tasting with the salts and the pH and everything else that's in the water by the time you use it, if you're using untreated water. It literally is the taste of the land that mm-hmm. the brewery or the well or the spring stands on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that. And water, I mean... Originally, before all the treatment methods that are used now, water did dictate some stuff.
Absolutely, some styles and I realized because
it created them.
It did so without people noticing. Mm-hmm. So people just knew that if you tried to brew a pale ale in Burton-on-Trent, it was better than a pale ale brewed anywhere else. They didn't know why for a long, long time. If they tried brewing lagers in Burton-on-Trent, it wouldn't have worked.
Right.
And conversely, you go to Pilsen, and they knew that just. The water was gently guiding them towards the perfect style for that region, mm-hmm. and you can't swap
right.
the lager and the pale ale over. Same with Dublin and stout. The roasted barley that they use in Guinness is quite acidic, and the water there just happens to be quite alkaline, so it balances out beautifully. They didn't know that. But it just works that way. And, you know, if they try to make a different style, it's just not quite as good as when they make that style. And so unknowingly, water, as you say, water has basically guided the development of some of our most distinctive beer styles in their places of origin.
Mm-hmm. And I think on the kind of talking about modern water, one thing at least in America, in United States particularly, is that a lot more breweries are thinking about the safety of their water, right?
Mm,
and
of
environmental
course, yeah.
conservation, we have a lot, of, you know, there's a lot of debate in fracking and what
yes,
how that will
yeah.
affect your water. I know that a lot of the Detroit brewers have had, you know, a really hard time. And so breweries around the country, you know, regardless of how much treatment, if you don't have clean water to start with, it's a difficult thing. So.
It is, yeah. And it's when you look beyond the brewing as well, that ratio of the amount of water used to what's in the beer. You know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, you were using 10 pints of water for every pint of beer you brewed. That's totally unsustainable now.
Yeah.
And I know people, and I was a bush manager, get that down to kind of 3 or 2
yeah.
pints beer water used for every pint brewed. I found in the book there's some brewers on the West Coast where you just had that drought forever.
Mm-hmm.
You got the experiments in using grey water. And recycling that
yep.
you know, from techniques that were pioneered by NASA,
right?
And so there's just once you dig into it, there's so much fascination there.
So you are just beginning your United States
yes.
tour, correct? So I have to ask: are there certain beers or certain styles that you're looking forward to drinking in the United States, or certain things that you're looking and experiencing?
Well, there's two aspects to that. One is that for all that we try in the UK, nothing quite equals the taste of hoppy IPAs in the US. We're still not quite there. I know how much effort's been put into things here, but we're just not there in terms of cold chain distribution. We're a long way from that. And also, even with cold chain distribution, you know, you're getting these hops fresher. You're probably getting them first ahead of us guys in the queue.
Mm-hmm.
And just the beers I'm having in, you know, fairly or established brands in fairly just okay bars, they taste better than a hoppy IPA does in the UK. So I always miss it. The other aspect to it is that whenever I come here, I always find something new that we're not yet doing in the UK. And I go back to the UK and I see it starting to happen. And it's like, oh, yeah, we're catching up. And then I come back over here again. It's like, oh, no, you guys have been moving forward as well. We're not catching you up at all. And so I'm just waiting to see what the new stuff is.
Cool.
I've been told to look out for lager.
Yes. Yeah, people are making some good pilsners here.
Oh, we've got it.
We're really excited about that here. Like, kind of, it's come full circle. Or like, brewers are very excited about having pilsners now because we went so far in the hop side. But us as brewers, like, man, we need something to drink while we're making these other stuff.
I'm waiting for malt to have its day.
Yeah,
I keep predicting. It's like, okay, we've done hops, and then I've got, right now it's going to be malt, and it wasn't. It was yeast and sour
because and it's bacteria. Like, yes.
Yeah, because if you're pushing the boundaries of flavor, that's the next most obvious place to go.
Right.
And then so that's kind of happened now, and I think one of the things with lager is, well, it's about, apart from refreshing and sessionability, it's about technical excellence.
Yes,
if you're gonna make a good lager, it's that's where the brewer can go, look at me, I don't just have to make stuff where I can dry hop the hell out of it to cover up my mistakes. There are no mistakes in my
brewery.
But at every juncture, I keep waiting for malt. You know, the incredible variety of flavors in different malts. I keep waiting for people to come back to that, and there just doesn't seem to be an appetite for it. But I'm hoping
soon,
it'll happen
hopefully.
Soon.
I totally agree with you. Also fascinating, we're seeing a lot more, like I was mentioning, New York State has this farm license. So we have maltsters in New York State and a lot of people growing grain and hops. But one thing is that hops can, you know, have a limited, kind of more limited areas of the country that they can be grown, but you can grow barley a lot more places. So I think that's one thing that we might see. You know, you could see barley from North Carolina and, you know, these kind of micro cultures, micro environments that produce different flavors of barley that we might not have even seen yet. I'm hoping that, you know, we'll see that and see, you know, that'll be a whole nother type of terroir of land taste.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing with four ingredients. You've got so many places you can go.
Yeah.
And at the end of the book, I had a really interesting conversation about Reinheitsgebot with people in Germany who both love and hate it. And the final word in the book goes to a guy who is a professor of brewing at Weinstefan, you know, the oldest brewery in the world. It's also a university. And he was just saying, he underlined the point that with four ingredients, the combinations of them, we've explored so little. I mean, it's great that people want to experiment with barrel aging and adding different fruit and different spices and that kind of stuff. Okay, fine. But what you can do with those four ingredients and just those four ingredients has barely scratched the surface. Mm-hmm. And the week that I spent in Bamberg was a wonderful week. And I was drinking a huge variety of beers, you know, Rauch beer, Marzen, Oktoberfest, Helles, Keller beer, you name it. And I got to the end of the week, I thought, shit, everything I've drunk this week has been a lager. That's how diverse lager is. Mm-hmm. when you push it as a style. And we just think of lager as this kind of golden pilsner, and it's there's so much there. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, if you're bored of, if you don't know where to go next, try a Marzen, try a Bock, try an Oktoberfest. And I think you guys in the States have, you know, there was always that kind of push to kind of nail all the styles when that was kind of the first wave of craft over here, I think, before people got more experimental. Was like, right, we've done British styles. What about French? What about Belgian? What about German? And we're still in the UK. We're still a bit too hidebound on it's either we've got our tradition, we've got to preserve that because it's got all British beer, or it's let's do whatever the Americans are doing.
We have the advantage of not having traditions.
Yeah,
yes. Exactly.
And by being sure to stay in that vein.
And on that note, we have to wrap up because we're out of time. But if you want to find more about Pete Brown, your website is petebrown.net, and you have your event calendar. His newest book is Miracle Brew, Hops, Barley, Water, Yeast, and the Nature of Beer, which is widely available on the internet and at bookstores near you. If your local bookstore does not carry it, please ask them to.
Pete, thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you. What a great chat.
Cheers and happy journeys.
Thank you very much.
Ferment about it.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.